of the feeding of the 5,000. It's probably one of the best known stories in the New Testament, one you probably know quite well. Those who went to Sunday school and who can still remember the experience can possibly remember being taught this story and in, certainly in my generation, possibly making a big frieze to stick on the church hall wall, which depicted what went on. Jesus, surrounded by a large crowd, it's getting late on in the day, and the people start to get hungry. People look around, confused, unsure what to do. Either these people were absolutely terrible at planning ahead and didn't realise they'd have to eat, or Jesus' teaching is so engaging that they can't help but listen and they lose track of the time. That's the explanation I like. The crowds were immersed in Jesus' teaching. I find it interesting that this miracle, the feeding of the 5,000, is the only one of Jesus' miracles that appear in all four Gospels. And there's only one significant difference between the accounts. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's the disciples who come to Jesus and ask him about food. But here in the lesson we heard this morning in John, it's Jesus who notices that the people are hungry and asks Philip, what's the plan for feeding these people? It's so typical of John's gospel that Jesus is the one who's always in control, always ready, always knowing what he's going to do. And it looks like, in this instance, he's almost asking as a test. And apparently Philip fails, because his response is the perfectly logical one. I have no idea. I think he probably then goes on to pick a random number, huge number, to tell Jesus, oh, it cost about 6 months' wages. In other words, more than they have. Feeding all these people would take a miracle. And then, fortunately, it's Andrew who comes to the rescue. There's a boy over there who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Now, these loaves aren't your huge big loaves. Barley loaves are wee small loaves. So what good's that going to do? 5 loaves and 2 little fish. It'll take a miracle. If you ask the disciples, that meagre amount of food would be a waste of time. It'll never be enough. I mean, you know, 5,000 hungry people. It's hard to get, just imagine how large a crowd that is. If you go to Pittodrie, double the figure you see there. No. If you go to Pittodrie, you'll get an idea of that kind of number. 5 loaves and 2 fish. Then Jesus asks everyone to sit down. He takes the loaves, 2 small fish, and he turns them into enough food for everyone to eat their fill. And in fact, with plenty of leftovers too. It's a nice, familiar story. Next, though, in today's lesson, we get this very quick account about the disciples getting into the boat, going across the lake in head of Jesus and going to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And as they're going along, it gets stormy. John, in his gospel, doesn't mention them asking if they're going to perish, but I think you can assume that they're pretty stressed by it all. Now, a few kilometres into their trip, they see someone walking across the water towards them. And as John records, they were terrified. An entirely reasonable reaction. People don't walk on water. Jesus reassures them. But then in John's gospel, instead of calming the storm, I don't know if you notice, when he joins them, they suddenly reach the land to which they're going. And for me, that's weirder than walking on the water thing, just transporting them to the side. It's a miracle. So what do we do with these miracle stories? The people involved and the people who were around at the time didn't have any problem with them. They followed Jesus because of the signs, because they were fed. And I don't know about you, but when I kind of read these stories, even though they're familiar, I don't seem to be able to simply accept them. My mind starts working on them. What's going on here? What might have actually happened? Did it happen as it's just portrayed? What's the truth? I don't know if you ever do that when you hear some Bible stories, but I often try and find some logical explanation. And that's what I do. Often I try to explain the miracles. When Jesus was at the wedding of Cana and all the wine runs out and Jesus miraculously turns the water into wine, how did that happen? Did he dilute the wine that was left? Was there hidden wine under the table? What was going on there? But let's take this story. Five little loaves, two fish that fed 5,000 people. Did the fish and bread simply grow back after somebody took a bite? Did Jesus multiply them at the beginning into hundreds of loaves and fish, dividing them among the people? Or did it happen, as many have suggested, through the people being moved by this child giving over everything he had, that they kind of started to feel the weight of their hidden food in their own clothes and the heavy guilt weighing down their hearts? And so as the baskets went round, people slipped some of their own food and fish in to share with everyone. And that, if I was going to explain it, would be my favourite explanation. But I think at times the miracle stories can be a real challenge to our faith, because they challenge the way we think and what we want to believe. Part of us, certainly part of me, I think, doesn't actually want Jesus breaking out of our nice little boxes of what's possible. Because it's like, certainly for me, afraid of what might happen if we dare to believe in a God who doesn't follow our rules. Because, you know, I know how this world works, and this isn't it. People don't walk in water. Bread doesn't come from free. It doesn't magically expand. This story doesn't fit how I see the world working. It's a miracle. It doesn't make sense. It's not explainable. Hard stories to believe when all the evidence we think we have says they're impossible. In a world where there are starving people, where there's so much going on that's wrong, wrong in our lives, wrong in the world, how can we possibly dare that God provides for us all? People don't walk in water. Bread doesn't multiply. But then in my experience, people don't rise from the dead either. There's no such thing as a free lunch or a free gift or free grace. That would be a miracle. But as I was writing these words earlier this week, on board an oil rig, as far from an ecclesiastical environment as you can imagine, the thought struck me that the real reason I try to explain miracles, I think, is because of all the miracles that don't happen in my life or the lives of those around me. If I can logically explain how this miracle happened, then maybe I don't have to wonder about why other miracles don't happen. As I said to you before, my entire ministry, stretching back about 30 years, has been firmly set in a secular setting. 24 years in the Air Force, ministering to a community where the average age was about 25. The last 5 years in the oil industry, with a somewhat older average age, but one which, like the Air Force, is hit very hard when illness or death visits. And because of the age range of these communities, I have over the years found myself in various challenging pastoral relationships. Whether visiting a terminally ill young man or a family up in the ARI with a terminally ill two-year-old, it's been a real privilege to have been allowed to sit with them and talk with them, share with them. But truth be told, I was and I will continue to be stuck at times for the right words to say. And there are times when I take my leave of families, the families I'm attempting to support, when I find myself asking that age-old question, why? Praying to God for a miracle to ease their pain. And that particular miracle hasn't happened. An example of why it might be more comfortable for me to be able to explain away biblical miracles. But then as I do mental gymnastics, trying to explain miracles, I get stuck and I get frustrated because I feel as if my whole life of faith is spent focusing on if and how something in the Bible really happened or not. And the truth is, we can never know, which makes me wonder whether I'm missing the point. Whether the point of the story isn't whether you believed that it happened or not, or whether there's a logical explanation. Maybe the point of the story isn't worry about whether it happened, but what's it trying to say? A few years ago, there was a film out called The Big Fish. It wasn't a huge blockbuster. I doubt if many of you saw it. But it has to be said it was a fascinating film. It's the story of Edward Bloom, and it tells the story about the day his son was born. And the story goes that using a fishing line that was so strong that it would hold up a bridge, and using only his wedding ring as bait, Edward caught an uncatchable fish. And he caught this fish on the day his son, Will, was born. Now, as the film went on over and over again, any chance he'd get, Edward would tell the story about how he caught this uncatchable fish, much to his son's, Will's, embarrassment. And over time, Will began to hate the story. He didn't believe it. He knew his father wasn't telling him the truth, and as a result, he lost all trust in his father. And over the years, they grew apart, and their relationship was strained. But then, many years later, Edward, the father, had a stroke. And as Will sat beside his father's bedside, in walks the doctor, the very doctor who had delivered Will that day. And the doctor asked him, "Have you ever heard the story about the day you were born?" "Oh, yeah, of course. 1,000 times he caught an uncatchable fish with a strong piece of string and only his wedding ring." "No," said the doctor, "I mean the real story. On the day you were born, your mother came in about 3 in the afternoon. It was her neighbour who drove her in because your father was away in business. You were born a week early, but there were no complications, perfect delivery. And your father was terribly, terribly sorry and guilty not to have been there. That's the real story of how you were born." Not very exciting, is it? I suppose if I had to choose between the true version and an elaborate one about a fish and a wedding ring, I might choose the fancier version. Edward Bloom told the story that on the day his son was born, he caught an uncatchable fish using just his wedding ring. Sometimes the point of the story isn't to worry about whether it happened or not, but what the story itself is trying to say. And here we are today, a story about a man named Jesus, a man whom we claim to be the revelation of God for us. And he feeds 5,000 hungry people with just five small loaves and 2 fish. And it's a story that says, if Jesus is able to feed people who are hungry, which to us means God is able to feed people who are hungry. But what I can't figure out is why Jesus used these 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish to feed everyone. He's Jesus. Why not just make bread and fish appear? But no, he used the small offering from a child, which amounts to almost nothing when you consider the size of the crowd. It says something that Jesus takes what this young boy has to offer. Because these puny, insignificant 5 loaves and 2 fish were used to feed all those gathered there. And its story is actually telling us, I think, that God can work with the meagre offerings of his people and do great things. It says that God can take the puny and insignificant things we've tucked away and kept hidden from those around us, and God can use. It says that when you've got almost nothing to give, God can use it. I do believe that we all of us, underestimate what God can achieve through each one of us. We worry we're not talented enough, we're not good enough, we're not strong enough to make a difference. And I bet there is a number of you sitting here this morning who have pushed really hard, forced yourself to do something you didn't think you were going to be able to do properly, and found that whenever you did it, even though you didn't think much of it, actually it made a difference to someone else. In fact, if we look through the Bible, this seems like God's favourite way to work in the world. God's favourite way seems to take something that's broken or worthless or empty and use it. God used the barren old woman Sarah to give birth to Isaac. God took Moses, a murderer, and used him to lead God's people out of Egypt. God used a peasant carpenter, and he was the saviour of the world, dying on a cross. In our Christian story, God doesn't conquer the world with power and might. God dies, and then God is resurrected, which means God will go to the darkest places of the world, the most empty places, the most void of any hope, the place of death, and God will bring about life. If there is one theme in the scriptures that can feed us, it's that God takes our successes and our gifts and also our weaknesses and our meagre places and uses them too. And to briefly go back to the pastoral situation I mentioned earlier, that of the terminally ill little child. When I visited that family in lots of times, and every time I returned, I was still racked with self-doubt. Worry I'd be stuck for words, say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, do something that would cause further distress or upset. And you might think, with all the years of ministry behind me, continuing training and experience, these doubts would be dispelled. They weren't. And you know, if I'm honest, I have to admit there were times when I have been stuck for words. I have said the wrong thing. And that doesn't help one's self-confidence. But here's the thing. It's clear from that family's response that God used my sometimes fumbling efforts to somehow speak to that family in a way way beyond my understanding, and which at times had me shaking my head. As we grow up, the messages we are fed and given is that our successes and our gifts are what we offer to the world. Get good marks, good qualifications, work hard, treat people right. These are all gifts to the world which God can use. But you know, the God we are dealing with won't just use your strengths and gifts. He'll use your broken places, your weaknesses. It's like God asks us this question. What do you offer me? And all we can see is, actually, not very much. To which God replies, fantastic. I can work with that. Amen.